Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Today we are asking whether Karl Marx is still relevant with our guest, Vanessa Christina Wills. I'd like to begin with a controversial declaration. We are all Marxists. I know this may sound strange, given how much the world has shifted to the right in the last two decades, but I'm going to double down. Almost everyone listening to me right now is indeed Marxist. Let me explain. Imagine your hobby is rebuilding motorcycles, and you spend a decade on one particular project. You go to junkyards, you scour eBay, you scavenge every single part from the carburetor to the brake lever. You meticulously clean and restore each component until you have before you the perfect motorcycle. Imagine also that just as you wipe off the last smudge, your best friend's truck pulls up carrying an identical motorcycle. It's the very same make, model, year, and in the same restored condition. And now you have a choice to make. You can't have two, you have to give one away. Which motorcycle are you keeping? Despite the initial gut punch, almost all of us share the same intuition. We are going to keep the one we made ourselves because that one is better. Why is it better? Because our motorcycle has something our friends does not. It contains our labor. In the late 17th century, John Locke introduced the idea that something becomes our property when we work on it in some way. An apple belongs to us when we pick it from a tree. A field belongs to us because we cultivate it ourselves. For Locke, everything in nature is free until someone acts on it to make it their own. Under Locke's understanding, property is a description. It tells us who has the right, who has the legitimate authority to acquire, keep, cultivate, modify, sell, or even destroy something. It doesn't, however, indicate that the asset changes in any way. An apple is still an apple, whether or not someone owns it. A field is still a field. The only thing that is different about an object before and after adding labor is the person who controls it. Marx challenges this. For him, property isn't just a legal change of status. It's a metaphysical one. When we mix our labor with something, we infuse it with a part of ourselves. For Locke, work is just an activity, a moving of the hand, a flexing of the muscle. For Marx, work is asserting ourselves on our environment. It is a form of self-realization and world-building. What the motorcycle example illustrates is that for Marx and for us, labor is real. The most difficult thing about today's episode will be talking philosophically about abstractions. To truly understand Marx, we have to grasp that not all reality can be sensed. Someone's working may be visible to us, but their labor, their presence that permeates the end product is not. Labor is a residual. It does not dissipate. We accept the reality of many abstractions. We think, for example, that love is real. But what might that mean? Maybe love is the term that designates the bodily reactions people experience when they touch their romantic partners. Maybe it's more psychological, a container for lovers' compatible wants, needs, and neuroses. Maybe love is something bigger, a metaphor we use to inhabit our sublime relationship with God. In each of these instances, love is real in much the way Homer Simpson is. It is an agreed-upon articulation of a concept that we imbue with meaning. For Marx, though, labor is real in a deeper sense. It is giving of one's identity, a unification of an actor in the thing which is acted upon. Labor is real change to a real changing world. Now, this is all very hard to describe, and I'm impatient to welcome today's guest, an expert on Marx's technical and dense writing. For the moment, though, I want us to return to what the hand-built motorcycle has that the other does not, our labor. Whatever that ineffable something is, however we choose to describe it, it exists, it has meaning, and its value is more than just economic. We are all, in some sense, Marxists because we know in our hearts that someone stealing our friend's motorcycle might be financially damaging, but their taking the one we built would be stealing 10 years of our lives. The first theft is a crime. The second is a tragedy. It is profoundly wrong to alienate us from our own labor. Labor alienation, literally making us alien to our own selves. This doesn't just happen with physical objects like motorcycles. We become estranged from abstractions too, such as our own knowledge or the institutions we create to govern ourselves. Labor builds the world that takes our labor away, and labor can rebuild it better. This is the heart of Marx's insight and the locus of his recommendations. In this episode, we're going to do two things. We will articulate the parts of Marx's theory that many of us already subscribe to, and we will examine his account of how history can usher in an epoch ideally suited to human flourishing. This will require precision because his writing intertwines descriptive and prescriptive theories. We will almost certainly find ourselves jumping back and forth between the way he argues the world is and what he believes it ought to be. What is most important, though, is that while we do this, we allow Marx to assert himself on his own terms and react to him with open-mindedness and respect. Karl Marx is scary to a lot of people, and we should acknowledge this. But philosophy requires courage, and a world full of suffering, such as the one we live in now, demands more than intellectual comfort. On today's show, we are asking whether Marx is still relevant, but we are starting with the realization that philosophy always is. After all, isn't that why you're listening to Why Radio in the first place? And now our guest. Vanessa Wills is an associate professor of philosophy at the George Washington University. She works on political philosophy and ethics and is an activist based in Washington, D.C. She's the author of Marx's Ethical Vision from Oxford University Press. Vanessa, welcome to Why.
Hi, thank you for having me.
To our listeners, if you'd like to participate, please share your favorite moments from the show and tag us on social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show, WHY Radio Show. Rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform so the others can find the show. And listen to almost 18 seasons worth of episodes for free, as well as our sister show, Philosophical Currents, at our website, whyradioshow.org. And as always, this show can only happen with your support. We exist solely on listener contributions. So click donate in the upper right-hand corner of our website to make your tax-deductible donation through the University of North Dakota Alumni Foundation portal. So with business done, Vanessa, I guess I want to begin where the monologue left off. Why do people have such powerful gut reactions to the mention of Marx and Marxism? People on both the left and the right have powerful associations with him, even if they've never read a line of his work. What's going on?
I think that's a great question. And of course, it varies a lot depending on what people we have in mind. I think for folks on, the first thing to say is that in my own experience, it's surprising how many people really don't know anything about Marx. And I don't just mean haven't read Marx or are unfamiliar with his theories, but I would say that quite often the response I get is a blank stare. And I think those of us who are very immersed in these ideas, it's easy to lose sight of, like, for how many people, it really doesn't mean that much. You know, they don't necessarily have a lot of pre-existing associations.
That's genuinely shocking. That feel, it feels like all of a sudden I looked out of my apartment for the first time, because Marx is everywhere in university life. And the people who attack the academy and politicians especially refer to us all as Marxists and communists, mm-hmm. and all these things. And so is this, are we in an echo chamber and that Marx is just not as present in the world as we think he is?
I mean, I might not go, echo chamber might be too harsh, you know, but I'm often myself surprised and reminded that I have to explain, like, who this person is and why he has the significance that he does for folks in politics and in academia. So I just think it's important to sort of put that on the table, right? That for lots of people, it's not this shocking reaction. It's no reaction, you know, or the reaction is a complete, like, mystery. I think for folks on the left, it varies, of course, with where they are on the left and how far. And I think importantly, one part of the reaction can be fear. And so one thing I talk about, you know, when I'm talking to people about how I came to this work, is when I started to work on Marx specifically, which was in the mid-2000s, I often had conversations with more senior academics who were very concerned for me and my well-being and what it would mean for my career if I associated myself with Marx's ideas. And that is because they were well aware that there have been numerous purges in the academy of leftist thought, of radical thought, and of Marxists. It's actually one of the things I talk about in my book. The very last chapter is about how Angela Davis, renowned, you know, she's still contributing so much to activism and theory in the late 60s, was one of the most prominent people to be attacked for her Marxist politics and was drummed out of UCLA by Ronald Reagan and the trustees, the Board of Regents there. And so that's the most well-known case, but then there's lots and lots of lesser-known people that whose names will never be well-known because it's been so effective. And I think that's also important to say, especially with the sort of widespread idea that being a Marxist is the straight path to fame and fortune or something. It ain't.
Because that's what Marx wanted, profit for all of his followers, right? That was the
right.
Being rich, being famous. Let me interject for a second, especially with what you had in mind, how you describe people's reactions. If I were to introduce Marx the following way, tell me if this is fair. Marx is the preeminent theorist on what communism is and what should be, and he's perceived as a revolutionary because he is the person who really was the trigger or the pivot point for the Russian Revolution, for the revolution in China that led to Maoism, that inspired Cuba's turn to communism, that Marx is both a theoretician and a symbol of radical revolutionary change away from capitalism towards communism. Is this a fair, brief, two-dimensional introduction that will allow us to continue to understand what you're saying while having a better sense of why people react to him the way they do?
I think that's right. And I would only add that it can be useful to think about Marx as the right intellect in the right place at the right time. I mean, he was a towering genius, but that alone wouldn't have been enough. He also happened to be a towering genius who was observing up close the transformation of the globe into this world capitalist economy and seeing the transformations of industrialization, modernization, liberalization in these European countries. We often think of Marx as a German thinker with good reason, of course, but it's important to recognize that Marx spent the majority of his adult life in London. And that he was in close collaboration, of course, with his co-author and co-conspirator, Friedrich Engels, who already had done quite a bit of research into the emergence of the working class in England. And I add that because it helps explain why it was that Marx was able to have the insights that he did. He was an incredible genius with a front row seat on these changes that were taking place. Also because it's common or to have a kind of knee-jerk reaction that says, well, that was a long time ago. You know, he was writing in the mid-1800s and late 1800s. Like, haven't things changed quite a bit? But importantly, Marx's time is our time. We still live under capitalism. It's the same system that he was observing. And so this is why when people read Marx, you know, when someone who has never heard of Marx before is handed a copy of the Communist Manifesto, they're like, well, this is just facts. You know, this is just this is what it was like at, you know, yesterday at the store, you know, like it all is so resonant. And I think that's really important to sort of push back against the idea that his ideas are sort of old-fashioned or outdated. If we understand that we live within a system called capitalism, and that it is that same very system that he was analyzing, then we can understand why his observations remain so relevant to us today.
So another important preparatory remark, I think, is to emphasize how systemic and how holistic and how revolutionary in the literal sense Marx was. Charles Dickens looked at industrialization, looked at child labor and the abuse and the exploitation, and said, we need workers' rights, we need empathy, we need a way to protect these kids, for example. And Marx looks at the same thing and says, we need a new system. Rights aren't going to do it. Someone overseeing the child labor isn't going to do it. The problem isn't a lack of rights and protection. The problem is capitalism itself. The problem is the system itself. We need to replace that and not move the deck chairs around the Titanic. Is that also a fair depiction?
I think that's right. And he also went a bit further to say that not only is the problem sort of just not articulating abstractly enough moral rights, but importantly, under capitalism, there are rights, and those rights are ones that ensure that this kind of harm will go on. The right that the capitalist has to control socially necessary resources without any input from or concern for the community, for how that affects workers, for how that affects people who need clean water to survive, need energy to survive, need all of the clothing, housing, right? All of these things that are required in order to survive. The capitalist is entirely within their rights to withhold those things and to hold them ransom unless they can be leveraged in some way to amass a greater and greater profit. So I think for Marx, it's not only that the mere appeal to rights is not going to do the trick, but also that we already have a system of rights, and that system continues to guarantee that this kind of inequality will go on and deepen.
So Jeff Bezos for Amazon can lower the salaries up to the point where people can't survive, and he hasn't done anything illegal. The governments of some states can say that 13-year-olds can work overnight, even when they have to go to school, and they haven't done anything illegal. And so the system lets itself propagate itself. Everyone can make the system bad while still doing legal things. And Marx is coming along and saying, even if it's illegal, and here's the connection to your book, even if it's illegal, it's not moral. It's not right. It doesn't lead to human flourishing. That's why he's opposed to the system, right? Because the system has set the rules up for itself to just keep the system going.
I think that's right. And I think it also goes to something that is a theme throughout my book and in another of my writing, which is that Marx unabashedly chooses a side. He is not claiming, pretending, in any way representing himself as some neutral observer in the battle between capitalist and proletarian. He is on the side of working people. And this is important because it goes also to the sort of scholarly controversy about whether what Marx is putting forward can be thought of as a moral perspective at all, because it's a bit murky, we can say, in what sense he is appealing to any sort of universal standard, right, or kind of universal ideals. And so one of the things that I'm talking about throughout the book is both his unabashed siding with working people. I mean, the most important reason from the point of view of a worker why not to give a damn about whether or not it's legal for your boss to starve you is that you're starving. I mean, that's the long and the short of it. The most important reason from the point of view of a working person not to care about the fact that it's completely legal for corporations to poison your water, poison the earth, is that you need to drink that water. You need to eat things grown in that earth. You need to breathe that poisoned air. It is a radically partisan perspective, grounded completely in the perspective of working people. What makes it also an objective and universally valid perspective is that working people who need to breathe that air, feed their kids, get to the hospital and not have a life-ruining bill at the end of it, cannot get those things without producing a radically different world that guarantees those goods to everyone. And so that is the connection between the particular perspective of the working person and the universal situation of all of humanity. This is also what makes the capitalist perspective, from Marx's point of view, irrational, because it cannot sustain human life. And what's incredible, especially at this moment, is the capitalists are increasingly willing to acknowledge this. And they're like, that's fine. I'll build a spaceship. I'll go to Mars. Those are the kinds of solutions they have on offer. So then the question is, well, what about the people that are not even in a position to put their billions into this escape plans?
I'm sorry, Vanessa, I need to interrupt for just a second because we have to take a break. Also, because there's tons of stuff that you just said that I want to pull those threads to make sure that people are following us. But for the moment, you're listening to Vanessa Wills and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
And you're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Vanessa Christina Wills, inspired by her new book, Marx's Ethical Vision, but we're asking whether Karl Marx is still relevant. And when we took the break, she was talking about understanding things from the worker's perspective and how even if something is legal, if it starves you, you don't care that it's legal. If the pollution is destroying the air quality and you need to breathe, legality isn't what's important to you. And so I want to ask you to talk for a second about this tension that comes up in the language we use, right? I said in the beginning of the show that we're all Marxists in one particular way, but another way that we are similar to Marx is that you're discussing worker versus owner, proletariat versus capitalist. There are all these other technical terms, bourgeoisie, for example. We are used to seeing the world in terms of classes, in terms of the material conditions of classes, in terms of, is this good or bad for the working person? Is this good or bad for the rich person? And yet at the same time, Marx wants to do that, but he also wants to argue that the worker is in the same situation all over the world. Famously, workers of the world unite. All you have to lose is your chains. What is going on with Marx that he can have one foot in the real living conditions of an oppressed person, a suffering person, and one foot in this universal, this collectivity, this, you're calling it objective? How does Marx do that? How does Marx negotiate one individual experience with the whole shebang?
It starts with asking, what do I mean when I say the worker, right? It's not like Bob, you know what I mean? You know, it's not necessarily like one sort of empirical, individual, concrete worker. It's more, you know, the worker in the same way that we might talk about the human. And it's a category into which those who sell their ability to work in order to obtain a wage, which they then use to satisfy their needs, all belong. So the person who is extremely marginalized, undocumented worker, doing day labor, risking the threat of arrest and torture with ICE to make money with no protections, part of which they'll send home, right, to someone who's depending on them. You know, that person is a worker, but so am I, right? You know, I am a tenured academic at a major university in DC. I'm able to feed myself, house myself, don't have that day-to-day insecurity, but I still, right, if I stop working, I'm going to have a problem. If I stop working, I will, right? You know, and so I am a worker, right? And so that's what the category of the worker is, right? And so because that's what that category it captures, most people on the planet are workers. Most people are members of the working class. Most of us have to sell our ability to work to somebody if we're going to sustain ourselves and our families. And so because that is the situation already of the majority of people on the planet, that already gets Marx a large part of the way towards offering a perspective that is going to be universal and do that kind of bridging among various differences and particularities, because most of us are already in that category of the worker.
So there are, I can imagine, voices responding in the following way. They're saying, it sounds like you think work is bad, but work is what makes human beings human, and even more so, idle hands are the devil's tools, right? Max Weber called it the Protestant ethic. There's a sense that we earn our existence, we justify our existence through work. And you seem to want to take that away. And what capitalism does, among other things, is let people work as hard as they want, to get as rich as they want, to choose their own profession, as Adam Smith used to say, that there's a negativity in your description because you're equating working with exploitation, regardless of how hard the work is. Is that a legitimate criticism? Is that a fair way of looking at what you're describing?
Great. I'm so glad you asked that question because it's absolutely true. We have to describe, what do we mean by work? So the word that I use in my book is typically labor, but of course these are synonyms. But labor is also the word that Marx's vocabulary often gets translated as when it's translated into English. So the German word is Arbeit, which can equally be translated as work or labor. I point that out just because people who sort of dig into more writing about Marx, because I think labor is the word that gets used more often. And Marx has a very different way of thinking about labor or work than the way that we whose work is exploited tend to think about it. And from early on in his 1844 manuscripts, which are some unpublished, well, in his lifetime, unpublished writings, he writes about alienation, about this sense of estrangement. And he argues that one of the ways we can tell that capitalism is distorting of our lives is the attitude that we have towards labor, towards work. The fact that when we think of work, we think of, oh God, this, I gotta go in, I gotta follow the instructions of this person who lords over me. I have to do these hated tasks. We think about a really odious, unpleasant, soul-destroying, humiliating ritual that we're forced into because we like eating and having a place to live, but would never do if it weren't necessary. And Marx argues that that is a symptom of work under capitalism, of what work is like under capitalism. But that work itself is, for him, this very broad concept that encapsulates all of the ways that we as human beings intervene into our world, our existence, our community, our environment, in order to realize our own aims, in order to bring into being the creatures of our imagination, in order to make our lives better and the lives of one another better. All of that is work. Raising a child, well, you know, people know it's work, hopefully, but like, but that's work. That's part of what he means when he talks about work. Playing an instrument, playing piano, having a soccer match, right? All of these things are ways of combining the activity of our mind with the activity of our body and using that to intervene into a physical world outside of ourselves, and also to intervene into a theoretical landscape. Writing a song is work. Writing a poem is work. And so yeah, I understand it's easy, I think, to read Marx and I think sort of superimpose a way of thinking about work that comes naturally if you are exploited and debased and demeaned every day, year after year, at your place of work. That's going to make work sound terrible. But for Marx, I think it's best to think of work as the sort of quintessentially human activity of creation.
So there are two different things going on here. The second, more abstract, which I want to get back to in a minute, is this work of creation, this human activity, this thing that is one of the things that in your book you argue Marx uses to separate human beings from animals, so to speak. And then there's this other kind of work, which for the sake of argument, I'll call employment for the moment, where you are making a wage and your boss is making a profit from your work. And the question I asked before about idle hands and work being valuable in itself, or I'll say employment being valuable in itself, that if you spend your time on the street corner talking to your friends, you are somehow less of a person than if you are working an 8-hour day, making a paycheck, et cetera. That value system is actually comes from a sort of false consciousness, a distortion that I'm going to describe this way. And this is a rough analogy. And if I get it wrong, I'm going to offend a lot of people. So I want to do this carefully. But lots of people will say women in particular, who are in abusive relationships, will say things like, "He hit me. That's how I know he loves me." right? When he ignores me, he doesn't love me. When he hits me, I know he loves me. When he hits me, I know he's there. And one of the reasons why they're in this relationship is their history is one of people they love abusing them. And there's something in this notion of employment that is akin to being an abusive relationship. Of course, we think that working for a paycheck is how we justify ourselves. We are being abused and exploited, just like some people who think that being hit is proof that they're valuable as well. There's something profoundly destructive and distorted going on in our justification of earning a paycheck. Is that a fair analogy? And can you talk a little bit about how Marx thinks the material conditions, the way we live, the system we are, forces us into that position?
Well, it makes me think back to something you said a few moments ago. You referenced the Protestant work ethic and the idea that idle hands are the devil's workshop. And I haven't thought about that saying in years, probably. But when you said it, I was like, you know, they probably are the devil's workshop. I mean, there's something about that saying that captures something, you know, correct, but in a highly distorted way, because, you know, I don't really think they're the devil's workshop. But it is true that if people have free time, if they have time that they control, that is not controlled by a boss. Let me give you another example of this. In the case of the United States, like a very, you know, very concrete case of the United States, the history of policing, of having a professional police force in the United States, is deeply rooted in capitalists requiring control over workers' free time. But in places like Boston and New York, you had policing emerge out of, how do we control these workers who, when they're not on the job, how do we make sure that they're not getting together to talk about forming a union, you know, like how do we police their leisure time, right? How do we, you know, when we think about the kind of policing of real leisure, you know, of what's going on at clubs, of raids on queer life, right? A lot of this is about holding the reins, and because there's a oversight problem. Free labor, right? Free wage labor is a great deal for the capitalist because it's up to the worker to figure out where they're going to eat and sleep and all of that. But it also means not as much surveillance. And that is a problem that was answered in part by the rise of more and more vigilant policing and more intrusive policing. And of course, in the South, people know well that the emergence of slave catcher patrols, but that then evolves into, you know, so much of the what's called the Bourbon Redemption, right? This backlash of the Southern white planter class against the gains that Black people had made during the Reconstruction period immediately following the Civil War had entirely to do with how do we control what these people are doing? They're not on the plantation anymore. So how do we create a new kind of plantation? And we have vagrancy laws, right, that make it illegal for you to be unemployed if you're a Black person in the South, that make it illegal to be out on the street, right, that just criminalize all of these behaviors. That and so much of this is just when you have a free group of wage laborers, they can be highly surveilled in the workplace, but then what do they do outside the workplace? And the emergence of policing in part to solve that problem for capitalism.
So we have this circumstance where in the workplace, the labor that workers engage in, the profits go to their employers or the owners of the firm or what have you, and they're surveilled and they're controlled to make sure that they only take 15-minute break, to they don't steal pencils, they're not looking at the internet, right? That efficiency and focus makes the owners money. Outside of the workplace, we want to make sure that we're still making owners money. So we take away the town square and make people go to a coffee shop where they buy coffee in order to be social with one another. We charge money for the parks or don't let people sleep there overnight. So we make homelessness illegal so that the landlords make money. And so the system is designed to maximize profits through control, is what you're arguing. And I'm really interested in Marx's answer to the question, how come then everyone isn't rebelling all of the time? How come, yes, there are people who are suffering and who try to unionize, who try to escape from the slave plantation, who rebel in a variety of ways, but as a general rule, especially in a capitalist society like the United States, most people not only don't rebel, most people embrace the system, call themselves capitalists, want to be a good American in that capitalist commercial sense. Why does Marx think that people are so eager to accept a system where he thinks they're suffering? Why do we say yes to a system that Marx thinks is so exploitative?
So I'll say I don't think it's necessarily that everything capitalists do can be immediately related to a profit motive. I do think, of course, that in the grand scheme of things, that's what it all is justified by, right, and in service of. But I think there's other things going on as well, which is fear. Fear, resentment, and hatred. So removing the possibility for working people to interact with one another outside of the gaze of the state isn't just about, in the immediate term, making sure that if you want to catch up with your friend, you're going to have to buy a beer, although that is, you know, that is true and it's annoying. But it's also because they're like desperately afraid of what y'all are going to talk about. And they just want that not to happen. And that leads to the second part of the answer I have for that question, which is, I think that when we tell the history of the U.S., but this is going to be true anywhere, but to talk about the case of the U.S., I think there is an unfortunate tendency to dismiss the role of terror, of terrorism. When workers organize and they do strike and they do things that have a real potential to transform their situation, what we see in the United States, in Chicago, in Pittsburgh, with the Homestead strike workers, where the Pinkertons were called in to shoot them dead, right? In the American South, where poor whites, if they were voting for the Republican Party, which in the early part of the 20th century would have been a more left-leaning party, terrorism was used to threaten them with guns, right? And so I think we sort of tell this story of the United States as one of quiescence, where workers are just sort of passively accepting, but they're not. And capitalists know that they're not. And that is why, for example, we have had a steady increase in spending for police in this country, but especially when you think about the demands of Black Lives Matter, the resurgence of Black Lives Matter activism that happened in 2020, and then the response to that was an increase in police funding in every major city in the country. And then we have our current administration pouring untold billions, right, into ICE and border policing, which is the sort of element of the American police infrastructure that has the least adherence to and respect for rule of law and civil liberties. So I think that's really important to sort of emphasize.
I think that's a really interesting response, that there are a lot more grumblings, a lot more anti-capitalist, pro-revolutionary. There's a lot more dissatisfaction than I was giving credit to. And we see that in the increase in surveillance. I know that four of my students were part of the original 200 Occupy Wall Street group. And they came from North Dakota. They were UND students. And they came from North Dakota, and they really embraced a lot of Marx as fuel for their resistance, as they would describe it. But there is a deeper epistemological and metaphysical knowledge and reality problem question that I'm trying to get at, and I'll ask it again, because I'm trying to get at Marx's notion of dialectical materialism. I'm trying to get at the notion that Marx believes that our historical conditions create the conditions for knowledge, that we know certain things, are aware of certain things because of where we are in history. We will know certain things as a serf and have a certain perspective on the world as a serf differently than we will as a citizen of in a capitalist society or what have you. So part of what I'm trying to get is, how does Marx see our self-awareness, our class awareness, our understanding of exploitation, how is that a product of how history unfolds and how the society we live in is structured?
So that is going to depend, of course, quite a lot on where you stand, where in the world you are, what kind of employment you have, what kind of belief system you might ascribe to, and so on. So one is to say that for most people, right, the thing that they know is going to be, you know, some version of, I can't survive like this. I can't survive like this and look at my boss. My boss is up there sitting pretty, and I can't feed my children. And that basic, just sort of immediate, right, that knowledge that I will not survive, my loved ones will not survive, we've got to do something else. I've got to change this situation somehow. Now, that kind of awareness, of course, admits of all kinds of different solutions. I decide, you know what? Thank goodness I'm in America, the place where I can make this American dream. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to start a business. I'm going to be my own boss, and I'm going to become a millionaire. So that kind of consciousness, that's of the sort of immediacy of the untenability of my situation, it doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to become a communist about it, right? But the connection between that and hopefully, you know, maybe meeting someone else who's like, you know what, we're all in the same boat. And here's why this is happening. You know, so it's got to be a connection between the sort of immediate observation of your own situation and your own circumstances, and then education. And I think this is something that people on the left can be too shy about. And there's a tendency to think like, oh, well, that's some sort of elitism. Like if you say that people need to read or they need to, you know, hear from Marx or, you know, or whomever, that you're sort of talking down to them. But I just think that sort of anti-intellectualism that can sometimes breed in left spaces, unfortunately, is first of all just a complete, you know, why leave on the table this whole rich tradition of history, theory, and analysis that previous revolutionaries have bequeathed us? I don't see the wisdom in that. And second of all, it's failing to take people seriously. I'll tell you who has trouble understanding Marx. Bourgeois. Workers generally are able to cotton on pretty quickly to Marx's theory. And so that kind of, yeah, that question of like knowledge, how do you come to know this theory? It's going to have to be teaching, education. Revolutionary education is extremely vital. Reading groups. I mean, one of the things that I say in the book is that just the sort of immediate experience of being exploited doesn't mean that you're going to have Das Kapital sort of emerge fully formed from your forehead, you know, like it's not going to happen. And so it has to be education, literacy with Marxist and left ideas together with the lived experience, and doing it in a way that helps people explain their lived experience, that says, here's why you are having the experience that you are, and it's not because you suck. It turns out there's a whole structural system that has virtually guaranteed that your life will be this way, but we can change that.
So communism is his vision of what a society would look like without this class conflict, where people flourish not just as individuals but as partners, and where our desires are going to be consistent with and not exploitative of other people. And you can see why a purely equal society, a society that values human creativity, human labor, is so important. I want to ask what may be an academic question, but one of the outgrowths of Marx's influence in the early 20th century, then the mid 20th century, is the development of things like ethnic studies programs, women's studies programs, things like that. And I want you to tell me if I'm getting this wrong. The way that I learned Marx and the way that I understood Marx was that, yes, human characteristics are malleable, human nature can change, and we can all labor to change that, but that to be a worker is to be stuck in a particular worker's perspective. To be a owner is to be stuck in an owner's perspective, and only at a very, very specific moment in time can workers have a certain moment, a eureka moment of seeing the whole, and that inspires the revolution. Ethnic studies programs and things like feminism inhabited that perspective by saying only women can see from women's perspectives. And only, we'll say, African Americans can see from an African American perspective, and only a gay male can see from a gay male perspective. That there's something about the dialectical materialism, there's something about our lived experience, the material conditions of the world, that define our knowledge and our perspective. And part of what he wants to do is break that cycle. And these approaches to knowledge and criticism and justice, like feminism, like African-American studies, is an extension of that, because what we need is these perspectives to be articulated for the people who can't see them. Is my understanding of Marx wrong, A, in the idea that I'm wrong, Marx thinks all form of knowledge is accessible to everybody at all points of time, you just have to read the right books and be smart enough and all that kind of stuff. And B, Am I right that these specific areas of research and studies is an outgrowth of Marx's insight that the life we live, the material conditions we experience ourselves, is going to define the knowledge that we have access to?
In general, that way of thinking about Marx is associated with the development of feminist standpoint theory. And this idea that, and there's different ways of being a feminist standpoint theorist. So some feminist standpoint theorists think, well, there are certain things about the world that women are going to be vastly more well-positioned to know because they are women, right? You know, like there's lots of things about tampons, right? You know, like that women are more likely to know, right? There's lots of things about childbirth, about why? Just in virtue of the fact that their lives involve interacting with those aspects of reality on a very intimate level all the time. But, you know, of course, these set of facts that women might be more likely to know, but that men could come to know by being told them. So that's one kind of feminist standpoint theory, right? Another strand says, no. There is a particularly and uniquely feminist kind of knowledge that women have that is impossible to render in universal terms, that it cannot be formulated in a way that anyone who's not a woman would be able to see it as real from their own point of view. They have to basically take it on faith. Feminist standpoint theory tends to be reading Marx through another thinker. And that thinker is the Hungarian Marxist philosopher Georg Lukács, who developed the idea of proletarian standpoint theory. And the proletarian standpoint theory was a way of formulating Marx's idea that there is a proletarian perspective, which I have said as well, right? You know, that there's a working class perspective and a way of seeing the world from this perspective. And that there's a kind of unique validity of that perspective. And that if you're outside of that perspective, it's going to be nearly impossible to see the world in the same way. But what's important is that for Marx, you know, Pache Lukács, what's important for that kind of reading is that working people are situated with a particular relationship to capitalism, that their relationship to the mechanism of capitalism is that of the working person who's selling their wage for a labor and who therefore has a kind of subjective experience as well of what it is to be a commodity, what it is to be a thing that is bought and sold, because they are selling their labor, which is them, you know, which is my own vital activity, right? It's me. And that gives a certain kind of vantage point. What's typical for various kinds of identity-based theories is to say that what is unique is the experience of oppression, of being oppressed as a woman, of being oppressed as a Black person, of being oppressed as a queer person, right? And that experience of oppression gives a particular kind of perspective on the world. So it's important, first of all, to just notice that a shift has happened, right? Because for Marx, oppression is not the thing, right? Oppression, sort of just being mistreated and harmed and debased, right? Those are not the things that give the working class perspective its unique in his view, objectivity, universality, and validity, right? It's that the working class perspective is the perspective of a kind of living subjective commodity, right? In a system where the commodity form is the dominant mode of being for people and things in society. The reason for regarding the working class perspective as unique is very different. And that is often sort of blurred over, I think, in the transition. And I'll just say quickly one other thing. Engels was a capitalist, you know, and
Engels
a Marxist,
was Marx's
course, right?
partner in writing and his patron. And so Engels is often a necessary component in telling the story, just so people know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's important that for Marx, the idea is not that if you are not a worker, that you cannot see what the world looks like from a working class perspective, precisely because the working class perspective, in Marx's view, has this universality in that the sort of self-interest of the worker is also the self-interest of every other person, because workers cannot solve the existential crises facing them without saving all of us, right? Without fundamentally transforming the world. And he argues that working class emancipation is impossible except by bringing about human emancipation generally. So yeah, so in short, for Marx, the idea that only workers can have this perspective that he's talking about, he does not think that at all. But rather, it's a question of, if you radically center this perspective, what then follows? If the thing you're centering is what is in the interest of working people, what then follows about what we ought to do and how we ought to transform the world?
That's a great way to start wrapping up, and we are out of time, but I do want to leave just a minute or two to have you directly answer the question of the episode. So you've addressed this, you know, throughout our discussion, but very explicitly, is Karl Marx still relevant today?
Yes, I certainly think so. And I think one reason why is because of something I mentioned at the top of the episode, which is that we still live under capitalism. You know, the system that he was analyzing is the one that we're in. And one of the most important things that he predicted was that capitalism would lead to deeper and deeper and deeper social crises, which is exactly what is happening. The answers to capitalism are not going to come from capitalism. We can see that if we just look at the problems of climate collapse. Capitalism has nothing to offer. And so I think that Marx is deeply relevant for explaining both why that is and what we ought to do, given that that's the case, how it is that we can use our collective power to save ourselves.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Vanessa, for helping us work through a very difficult thinker, a very influential person, but also someone for whom interpretation is complex and there are a lot of different points of view about what he's saying. Helping us negotiate that has been tremendously interesting. Thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Vanessa Christina Wills and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'll be back with a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org. Thank you.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Vanessa Christina Wills about Karl Marx, asking whether he is still relevant, and diving into her new book, Marx's Ethical Vision. It's hard with someone like Marx because, on the one hand, he is this tremendous figure who has influenced people politically through popular culture. He has a status as a symbol, almost a deity for many people. He has had real world influence in profound ways and triggered revolutions. At the same time, he is this academic philosopher with thousands and thousands of pages that philosophers argue about and that people really disagree about what he's saying and what he's not saying. And it's very easy to get into the weeds. And so it's hard to know where to start with him. And sometimes a secondary source or a show like this is a good beginning. Most people start with the Communist Manifesto. I would absolutely recommend that. It is still powerful. It's hard to read at times. It's technical, but it's very, very powerful. And at the core of it is this idea that we came to towards the end, which is there's a certain perspective that we need to adopt, the perspective of the worker, the perspective of someone who has become a commodity that we need to attend to in order to promote change. Something weird has happened in the last 15 years or so. We have shifted to looking towards billionaires for our leadership. We elect rich people in part because they're rich. There is something that we glorify about the wealthiest. And there may be some good things about that. That's a matter of personal perspective. But what the wealthy can't see is this commodification, the sense of being a product, the sense of being bought and sold. I often think about the argument that people who do things like sex work, people who do OnlyFans, people who are cam models, only do it because they're forced into it, because they are forced into an exploitative profession that diminishes them. But people are forced into working for McDonald's too. And people are forced to take minimum wage jobs with horrible bosses and horrible conditions and mines that collapse on them and give them black lung and being on the road in your truck for 18 hours at a time. We are all forced into things because we need to survive, and in order to survive, we have to make money. In order to make money, we have to sell ourselves. Is that the only way to be? That's Marx's question. Is being a commodity, is being someone who is bought and sold, the only form of human existence? His answer is no. He thinks all of our answers ought to be no. And he gives us a picture of what it might look like to learn, to argue, to push, and to fight for a different way of being in the world where we are flourishing humans and not products that are valued only for the labor that other people can get off of us. With all that said, if you've been listening to this episode on Sunday evening on Prairie Public, please know that a longer version with almost 30 more minutes of discussion is available online and as a podcast. Visit whyradioshow.org to listen or subscribe for free. For everyone else, rate us on iTunes and Spotify to help spread the word about the show. Follow us on all the usual social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show, WHY Radio Show. And please help us continue broadcasting by making your tax-deductible donation at whyradioshow.org. Click donate in the upper right-hand corner to go to UND's alumni donation portal. We exist solely on the money you provide. Thank you yet again to my guests, the folks at Prairie Public, especially our engineer, Tay Calloway. I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, signing off for Why Radio. Thanks for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua e Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/markweinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.